Blog Talk Radio.
Aloha, welcome to Talking Pictures. This is episode 200, as of course you see that on your screen. However you've received it has probably had something that says episode 200. I'm trying to think back to the day we did episode one. I remember I was just so nervous. I still like to believe I don't know what I'm doing, because that keeps you fresh, keeps you in the game, wanting to do better. But before I go off philosophizing on myself or film, what I want to do is say thank you to everyone, our producers, PR reps, film festivals, every guest we've ever had, event that we've covered, anyone who's given us an interview, who's shared us on Facebook, who's liked us on Facebook, anyone who's recommended a guest or a film or something we should cover. This is all for you guys. We get to be the lucky ones in the middle who can use this show to service film and filmmakers and service festivals. Yeah, I always say in this, we're the lucky ones. We get to meet everybody. We get to see stuff sometimes before it comes out. We get to see filmmakers. It's really cool. One of the funnest parts is sometimes we'll see a movie and then there's a different cut of it at the film festival. So you get to kind of understand more of the process of what the filmmaker was doing and going for. And that's always special. We appreciate that trust. We work to have that trust with filmmakers, and we work to preserve that trust. Today we have a great timetable for you of guests, where we have five guests lined up for you. And I'm also going to be making some recommendations of stuff that's out there on the festival circuit. Our past guests are tearing it up right now on the festival circuit, and I love to see that, because their past work always tells me, you know, whatever's next is going to be great. And we've had a few guests that have come back three or four times. We've had guests that are going to be coming back, but it's so hard to schedule this show. I mean, I think the record is going to be set when we have a guest on in June that literally we've talked about having her on for probably, I know, over 6 months, because we were talking about it before Christmas, and she'll be on in June. Now, her film dictated that, but excuse me, it's kind of funny to look back and think, wow, this show has now hit a place where even if it's just schedules, ours, theirs, or the film, that the show went from how are we going to get next week's guest, who's going to be able to be next week's guest, to we're booking weeks out, months out. I mean, to think that we waited, you know, it's closer to 8 months now that I think about it, and I can't wait to have this guest on. She's awesome. And then on top of that, it's going to kind of be like a mutual joke of like, wow, you're actually here. So today, first of all, I'm going to talk about two films that are on the festival circuit, and I'm going to reference the Brooklyn Film Festival, which I've never been to, but last year, one of our guests, she won the Brooklyn Film Festival with her film Creed Moria, Alicia Slimmer. You can Google anything, and we also have archives on our new website. So forget that Google. What does Google need? They don't need more hits. You can go to our official website, www.talkingpicturesla.com. That's www.talkingpicturesla.com. In the top right corner, you'll see podcast episodes. That'll lead you to the archives. Unfortunately, the archives go from yesterday backwards. So I want you to do it that way and scroll down by date. You can go to June of last year. Maybe I think it's on page 3 of the archives. And we have a review of Creed Moria. We have Alicia coming on and talking about it. She had won Dance of the Films and the Brooklyn Film Festival on the same night. And again, that's a shout out to Jonah, Kim Dixon, our not our PR reps, but PR reps we love working with. But Dances with Films, that's how I was introduced to, or Kim Dixon is how I was introduced to Dances with Films. And Jonah was Creedmoor, I believe, because I remember that when that won too. Yeah, anyways, going to be a lot of thank yous today because I don't believe in self-servant BS in this business. I don't believe any of us do it alone. And so with that, Brooklyn Film Festival, they have the filmmakers have not put out their screening time yet. Otherwise, I would definitely have that here for you. I wouldn't be like talking about a film festival and you guys would be like, why is he talking about a film festival not telling us the days? Both of them announced yesterday, which I'm assuming the Brooklyn Film Festival told everyone yesterday. So the first one is The Archer, which we've talked about a number of times on this show. Valerie Weiss, please check out her film, A Light Beneath Their Feet, on Netflix. More than worth it. The Archer is something I got to see twice. I got to see it on screener while it was premiering at South by Southwest, and then I got to see it at the Newport Beach Film Festival. We're going to be working to have Valerie's editor on, and you're going to want to follow these directors, as we'll eventually have a list of directors to watch on that www.talkingpicturesla.com. We have podcast episodes, which goes to our archives. We'll eventually have films. We've had 16 or 17 filmmakers with films on Amazon Prime and Netflix. And then we'll have festivals and what our guests are up to. That's our ultimate goal. So the guests get a continuous, evolving promotion of their work. They're always welcome back. Once you're a guest on the show, you can come back. 200. I'm looking at the screen. I'm thinking 200. I remember how excited I was. I think we had did something special for 50. I remember number 75. Speaking of past guests, on June 4th at Dances with Films, Three Skeleton Key from Marcus Mizell. He's the producer of it. The last time he was on, it was for directing Actor for Hire, which played Dances with Films last year. Marcus is a hoot to have on. There's just something, his personality, his sense of humor. He's come on twice. He was our 75th episode. I remember thinking, you know, that was kind of a tough, turbulent just time in my life. And I remember kind of thinking, you know, where's the show going from here? And, you know, Marcus is one of those guys that just talking with him is just a nice boost. Funny guy, and it's just keep an eye out, please. He's going to be coming back on for this film. Of course, we never know when, because the nature of the film business, I don't like saying Hollywood because that's pretentious as shit. Pardon my language. We're going to be having mostly ladies on today, so I'm going to have to really watch my no censorship rule. I don't swear just to swear, but anyways. So The Archer, and then this film called titled The Sounding, directed by Catherine Eaton. She's been on before the film was finished, and I ended up seeing this film at CineQuest, which I was this complete bonehead that did not know CineQuest was one of the like coolest festivals on the planet. And I think I probably had that in my brain that it wasn't that cool because it was San Jose. Now, I'm not a San Jose hater. I actually love San Jose because my late grandmother used to live in Sunnyvale and Mountain View. And that is, that's like saying New York, that's like saying Manhattan and the Bronx or Manhattan and Queens. And so, to me, it's just not the place that you would think this great, renowned festival takes place because the downtown is so boring. And that's no offense to CineQuest because, like I just said, they're one of the coolest festivals on the planet. Attending CineQuest, I did for 2 days. I made more connections than I make it sometimes at a five-day festival. Everyone there was awesome. All the films were awesome. But The Sounding, back to that, we're just awaiting our first caller here. The Sounding, can I put this? It was one of those films where I was so engulfed in the performance by the actress, and then I'm forgetting the whole time that Catherine directed herself. So I'm not spending all this time going, oh my God, this is such amazing directing. I'm going, how did this actress pull this off? Knowing full well that Catherine was a co-writer and the director. And so it was, I think it was one of the first times that that happened to me. I mean, you watch a Woody Allen movie, you know he's directing himself. You watch, I don't know, there's so few other examples. If you see Scorsese do a cameo or you see anyone do a cameo, you know they're directing themselves, even if just in a cameo. Yeah, The Sounding. I'm sorry. These two films had such an effect on me. These were two of the films where I kind of had to step back and be like, wow, this is some serious directing. This is, I'm not going to get into the women's revolution, the women's thing. We're all about equality here. I don't even like saying women directors, even though it's proper to say women directors. I mean, The Archer is just, there's so many different films that it's a collage of, but it's original. And The Sounding is, I mean, I can't even think of the way the script lays out, the dialogue. I think everybody's going to jump and say, oh, you know, Pulp Fiction was the most original dialogue, or Reservoir Dogs, or, and I understand that. That was what we're conditioned to think, and depending on your generation. But this was really the one where, you know, it was just unique. It was, I mean, and that's an understatement. I remember, sorry here, just a little bit of, I cannot say how this happens on air, but we're rolling, we're live, and I think it's better that I talk with a clear throat. Thought I'd had enough water here before I went on. Sorry about that. Oh man, I don't like when that happens. You guys don't tune in to hear me drinking water. So The Sounding and The Archer are two films that you have to get out and see, and they are playing the Brooklyn Film Festival. So I am not just throwing out films to see. One, another film that I want to say real quick, to yesterday's episode, which I hope you did. So I hope right now you're saying, I heard this yesterday, Paul, why are you talking about it again? Losing Sight of Shore. When it comes to a film festival in your area, please support film festivals, support filmmakers, go out and see their work. They love having a nice audience. But if you are someone who can't go to festivals, as I said yesterday, there's people that don't like crowds. There's people that don't, they have different phobias. They don't like going out. If you have Netflix, check out the film. And again, I have, you know, I personally don't like crowds. So sometimes I'll step out of a party, or I don't like going to a screening if it's sold out, because like I said, I don't like crowds. So, only if it's something I absolutely have to see will I go to a sold-out screening. So with that, Losing Sight of Shore, all I'm going to just say is really cool documentary, inspiring, a testament to what humans can do if they really, if they really step out there. And that's one you can catch on Netflix, so be prepared for that. Let's see, we're just waiting on a guest to call in, and we understand that that's just the way it goes sometimes. Not all of us have our watches. Remember that crazy show, Parker Lewis, where they would say, sync watches, and as little kids, we would think that that really mattered. But it's what's making me think of right now. Nothing against the guests. It's just the fact that we're all busy people. And let's see, I have a caller coming in now, and it doesn't say their name, so let's see who this is. Plus, I want you guys to be surprised. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Paul, it's Anna Musso calling.
Hey, Anna, how are you today?
I'm great, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, other than some trying to keep hydrated while watching the clock of how long I have to talk without hearing people having people hear me gulp water. But what's up? What's new in the zoo?
Oh, not all that much. Not all that much. I've just been, you're catching me in a writing day, so I'm, please forgive me, my headspace is a little bit writerly today. I've just been, you know, beating my head against the computer, so.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, what are you breaking?
Well, I'm writing a feature, and yeah, so I'm writing a feature that I hope to make. That's my next goal. Yeah, and you know, when that place when you're sort of just still in it. Here's what I can share with you. I'll tell you, I'm writing a story about. It takes place in Chicago, which is my hometown, and I'm writing a story. It's about a wealthy widow who learns her late husband's mistress has been kidnapped, and she discovers there might be reasons to pay the ransom that have nothing to do with the ransom itself, and. That's all I'm going to share with you.
Well, I know, but that's cool because I like what you're saying, because usually the wife would want to kill the mistress, so that it wouldn't really. That's what came out of my mind. I'm like, why would she care to save the mistress? That she'd be the first suspect.
Yeah. Now, it's a bizarre little story.
So another thing that we wanted to talk about was because we've told guests to reference the archives. How did Run Fast finish for you? I know we were talking and you had some festivals, and then like how did that experience wrap for you?
It was great. It was great. We got to play at a handful of wonderful festivals, and it was wonderful. You know, I of course, so making a 22-minute film, it's tricky getting a 22-minute film into festivals. But nevertheless, I was really grateful, you know, for it to play in many wonderful places as it did. We played Palm Springs, and we played, gosh, you know, honestly, that was like a while ago. So
yeah, I was just thinking we're doing our Palm Springs applications, and I think I put on there that it's like, oh, we've been there 3 years in a row, and I was like, was it really that long ago? Because that was our first year at Palm Springs when we saw Run Fast, and I was going to say, all I remember about seeing Run Fast was that I had three different shorts that literally played back to back to back, and they didn't want to let me in yours because they said you can only go to two at a time. And I remember being in the lobby being like, but no, I know the director. And they were just kind of looking at me like this was some excuse, right? Like, you know, I mean, it's a nice way. Like, I'm trying to be like, Woody Allen's in the room, but I know him, you know? Like, I was just like, it's Anna. I know Anna. I'm like, I want to see her film. So they finally let me in, and it was the second your film started. So,
that's craziness that they wouldn't like. That's nuts. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's
at all.
What I was saying. I was like, I'm here to cover films. Like, why are you? I'm like, you're taking press from filmmakers, you know, because I like to get on my soapbox. All I remember was you know, the heat of that place, and thinking I gotta go see Anna's film in a t-shirt. I want to put on something nice, but Anna's just gonna have to deal with a t-shirt and jeans. That's all there is to it. Everybody
funny.
That knows
that's
Palm
really
Springs.
Funny. Well, Palm Springs, though, that's the one thing about it is it really makes you want to be in a movie theater because you have to be in either a pool or a movie theater in Palm Springs because it's so unbearably hot there. Yeah.
Right. What is anything you can tell us about what you're doing? On a professional level, not specifically what you're doing now, but just in general, what you do.
Yeah, well,
not
I mean,
specifically,
I can tell you
what I mean? Like,
well, I can tell. Well, I mean, I can definitely tell you that I'm working. I can tell you I'm fortunate enough to be working on the film Downsizing. I'm lucky enough to be doing that, and it's been a really great extension of my education to be able to observe that film being made, and I'm really excited for when the time comes that people get to see it. I can tell you that.
Yes. I appreciate that, because we've all been waiting on those films, and I love the best part. I like for us doing this show is meeting filmmakers. We get to your first film, L Train.
You're cutting out.
Oh, am
I'm sorry,
I? Am
you I? Cut out. I missed that last sentence.
Okay, so like we get to see stuff like L Train and Run Fast, and then we have filmmakers that are, you know, get to work on these other great films, and so we get to experience. I love that we get to experience both sides and see filmmakers that get to, like my friend does visual effects, and he did like Divergent and Godzilla and Fast and the Furious 7 and 8, which are all films that I can't really watch because my epilepsy.
I
go and watch them because he did effects. And so it's really nice because we get to have, like today, for instance, he was going to come on air, but he's now with a different effects company. So he's like, I can't be calling into your show on my first day at work. which you would know, you know, on the other side of the business that you've seen and been a part of. It's like, that would definitely be a big no-no. So even though he's my film school roommate, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to push it. So is there something...
Well, I get that.
Is there, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a number one. I mean, the way we met, like, you know, most lost my job because I was talking film with someone. So it's such a weird, different world. Is there something that you've seen lately that you would love to tell us about or something to recommend?
Oh, boy. Let's see. Well, you know, I would be the 4 millionth person to say that I saw Get Out, and I'm sure you've already talked about that because who hasn't? You know, can I say something that's maybe a little like you've also probably already talked about, but I just rewatched, I don't know if this is like maybe, you know, again, this is maybe in the past, but I revisited the film Ida the other night. Do you know that film by I'm going to destroy his name. Pavel Pavlikowski?
No, I haven't seen that, actually.
Oh, get out of here. Seriously? Run and get the – it's on Blu-ray. It's called Ida. It won Best Foreign – film in not this past year but the year before, I think it premiered at Telluride and then of course went on to win it Best Foreign Film, and I also believe, if I'm not mistaken, at Camera Image in Poland, I want to say that it took home the Best Cinematography Award at Camera Image. I could be mistaken about that, but in any event, I hadn't seen it in a while. And I revisited that film, and wow, is it a masterpiece. If you have not seen that film, run and purchase the Blu-ray. It is just absolutely phenomenal. Every frame in that film is incredible, and I was watching the you know, bonus features or whatever, and they interview Pavlikowski talking about it. And what I didn't know about the film is that he was searching like high and low throughout Poland to find a cinematographer. And he, amazingly, in Poland, where you think like, you know, that would not be difficult, he had a really difficult time finding somebody. And he ended up hiring like a 19-year-old cinematographer who had never shot anything before. And the film is just an absolute masterpiece. It's absolutely breathtaking. And the protagonist of the film had never acted in a film before. They found her in this cafe, and it's just an absolutely stunning film. I don't want to even tell you the premise, because if you haven't seen it, you should know nothing about it. Just watch it. It's great.
Well, you know, the reason why that jumped out in my mind was because it won. It was the first year I was covering the American Society of Cinematographer Awards, and it won. And I remember it hadn't really come to Orange County, and that was why I hadn't seen it. And I remember I was all frustrated because I've covered the award show for 3 years, and for some reason each year I have a goal for next year. I've always seen four of the five nominees. And so I'm always like, why do I always only watch four of them? So that's why when you said it, I was like, I remember being like, really, I took this time to see these four movies. I went to these $14 art house movie theaters. the cost of the seeing the movies was half the cost of my tux. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, so what is this? And so when you said that, and I'm looking here, it has like every festival you could think of on the poster. And I didn't look at the synopsis, but I was just looking up the, of course, it was up for an Oscar for cinematography. And which of course you know is has a director is such a bananas art form. On a on that note, with you watching this film, do you I always wonder, I don't know why I've never asked another filmmaker this, how do you turn off, or does it never turn off, the filmmaker and the writer and the film lover side? To where you're not analyzing everything, anything. Do you ever find that possible?
To turn that off? You mean like when I'm watching someone else's work?
Yeah, like when you're watching a film, like have you hit that point where it's like just you're a filmmaker and you've made films and you've worked with so many filmmakers that it's just like you can't just watch a film and not notice great cinematography or great editing or something a director's doing that you haven't seen before?
Well, you know, I think actually with great work, I don't know about anyone else, but with me, I find that with great work, I don't realize it until later. Like, in other words, I find myself so taken away by the film, and then maybe perhaps afterwards, I'll catch myself saying, I mean, I was so swept away. Like, here, another example. I believe you had Greg Fraser on the show, and he's an absolute hero of mine. And when I saw Lion, that's a great example. I was so swept away by that film, and I felt like it picked me up and carried me. And it wasn't until after I saw the film that I found myself, then I looked back and went, why was I so taken film? And then maybe then I would look back and try to understand perhaps why it was that I was so taken. And I think he would be a big reason why I was so moved. You know, in other words, the cinematography in that film I found also to be just, again, that's another example I think of. And I feel like I've twice now used the word masterpiece, and it's not a word I use lightly.
It's a hard one to not use for filmmakers, because it's like you see five in a week, and you're like, okay, what does that word mean?
Yeah.
Like the word genius, you know, when you're like, huh, when does that word start
I actually,
to value?
Yeah. Despite my use of it twice now in 10 minutes, I truly don't use that word often. But that's just another example that actually came to my mind. Like, 'cause I remember seeing that film last year and being really swept away by it, but not at all, while I was watching it, not at all paying attention to the mechanics of it or thinking about it. I wasn't cerebrally trying to like work it out in my mind, like, why is this film working? It was only upon maybe a second viewing that I said, why is this film working the way it's working? And then I want to study it. But I think a great film, when you're seeing it for the first time, I don't know, for me anyway, I just find myself enraptured. And then maybe on a second viewing, I might want to try to understand why it's working so that I can learn something from it. I don't know if that answers the question.
Oh, no, that's perfect, and that's a perfect film. Is this Jason?
Yes, it is.
Is that you, Jason? Hi, Jason.
Yes,
Jason,
Jason,
meet Anna Musso. Musso, Anna, meet Jason.
Hi,
this
Anna.
Hi, Jason.
These
Hi.
Are two, Anna and I were talking about Lion, which made me cry like a little baby because I have a brother I don't get along with, so for me, I just kind of checked out of the movie, and we are talking about the cinematography of Greg Fraser. Jason's here today to talk about many things, but I wouldn't want to say, hey, Anna, just see you later. So if you'd like to stick around for a few minutes, you can. If you want to get back to writing, that's your call.
I'd love to, but unfortunately, I do have to jump off, and I want to allow you guys to talk. But Jason, it's been lovely to meet you. I'll be it briefly. And
awesome.
Well,
all right, thank
it's been
you.
Wonderful talking with you. So,
we'll
wish
see
you guys
again because it's a small world.
I'm sure we will. I look forward to it.
Awesome.
All right.
Take care, Anna. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
All right, Jason. Oh, we want to thank, of course, we want to thank Anna Musso for stopping by. Met her on a film set, The Descendants, in Hawaii, and it was just great. And she was our fifth or sixth guest, and so it's very cool to have her back for number 200. Jason, how are you today? What's going on, my man?
Was The Descendants a short film about...
No, it was...
I might have thought it was a different film that I saw. I saw a film at the Big Island Film Festival, and I think it had a very similar title. But it was about the history of Hawaii, and it was a very interesting film. Anyway, let's move on. What do you want to talk about? I love to talk about film. I'm all in.
Well, exactly. We had just been discussing a film she recently saw, and then we got on the subject of cinematographers. So that could bring me to a great question with your films. I didn't pay attention for some reason. Do you use the cinematographer, or how as a director do you choose cinematographers? For your work, I've only seen a feature and a short, and that's very rare with filmmakers. I usually just see short, or feature. So what's your process like for that?
I mean... Here's the thing. I mean, when you're working low budget and you work kind of, you have odd schedules, a lot of times you can't work with the same people consistently. Especially, you know, I've had kind of an erratic output as a filmmaker. And there's a lot of people that, you know, like move on and do different jobs, bigger jobs. They have to go off to another country. I think that the main thing, a lot of times I'll be working with someone I haven't worked with before, but maybe I like their work. It's pretty much any type of like job situation where you interview someone, and talk to them about, you know, how they work, the only difference is, you know, you're also talking aesthetics. And the first thing you do when you're hiring a cinematographer is you send them the script. And to me, that's really important, that make sure that they read the script, what type of visual ideas they get from looking at the script. If you feel like they understand the story because the cinematographer, you know, really is one of your biggest allies in telling the story. So, I remember there was like, so I remember when I was working on Seahorses, and I had a friend that, recommended a cinematographer, and, you know, and I saw their work, and it was really good and professional, and I remember sending him the script and talking to him for, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes before sending him the script. He read the script, and he's like, oh, yeah, I really like it. You know, it's really good. I really don't get the script. I don't really know what I don't really know what you're trying to say, but, you know, I really like this and this and this. I'm like, well, maybe if someone doesn't understand the script or doesn't really, it's not really their cup of tea, then perhaps they're not a proper fit for the particular film. The other element, too, is, I mean, I think that certain cinematographers are good for drama. Certain ones, you know, understand comedy. The last short that I did was a comic film, and I had a friend that did a lot of work with, you know, broad comedy. And so we shot all on a jib, and that was sort of a kind of creating an interesting world, like a wide angle world. So I just think, I mean, it's dependent on the project. It's dependent on how you feel about the person. And really they're an instrumental part of the team. So it's all, you know, it's kind of human resources as well, you know, making sure that, you know, they work well with others and, you know, they can assemble a good camera team that maybe of people that they've worked with before. It's about relationships. It's about art. It's about a lot of different things. I hope I answered the question. No, that did.
And that brought up in my mind Subculture, which, excuse me, will be playing at Dances with Films for our LA friends and listeners June 2nd. Subculture was something I saw at CineQuest. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. CineQuest, was that the premiere?
Yeah, we had our world premiere at CineQuest.
I thought that's what I thought.
To plug things on 200.
Well, I can plug.
Oh, you're allowed to plug. Okay, I'll let you plug as much as you want to plug. I wanted to tell you about my favorite film.
Oh yeah,
can I do
please
that?
Do. Yeah, you could do that. Do that. Yeah.
I want to do that. You guys,
Yeah,
if you want, I mean, definitely, you know, I'll be around in Hollywood. We're going to have some really cool events for Subculture, and it's a really fun short. It's playing with some great films. But I just thought about it when, you know, it's like, what is your favorite film? And I mean, I have a million favorite films, but there's one film that I feel like is very, very important to me, was important to me as a filmmaker, was important to me sort of at a formative time when I wanted to decide like what I want to do with my life. And some people know it really well. You know, most people don't. It was nominated for an Oscar, 1980, for best picture. It was also nominated for best screenplay. It's a film called The Stuntman, directed by Richard Rush.
I've heard of that. Yeah.
And it's an amazing film if you haven't seen it. It's about making films. They shot it in San Diego at the Hotel Del Coronado. So every time I go to the Hotel Del Coronado, there's incredible, like, you know, turn of the century palace where they shot another wonderful film, Some Like It Hot.
I was going to say, you're going to pick The Stuntman over Some Like It Hot, but go ahead.
you gotta see the movie if you haven't seen it.
Oh no, I've seen it. I've always seen it once.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of those I found it on VHS, and then it, like, you know, so many things vanished with VHS. But go ahead.
I'm saying that this film taught me a lot about making films and what you can do with maybe one setting, how you can manipulate the audience's perspective. And it has a brilliant central performance by one of my favorite actors, Peter O'Toole. So I just wanted to throw that out as a film that probably the most important film in my life was that film, because it came at a time, you know, I mean I can also, you know, you can say the greatest hits like Star Wars, or if you're a horror person like I am as well, like The Thing, or but that film sort of this film that always stays with me, and especially the way it changes the narrative and messes with the audience's mind. And I think that's what I think is sometimes our objective as filmmakers is we are here to make people feel, make people, you know, change people's perspective, show people a different world. You know, maybe manipulate them once in a while, but in a good way. You know, hopefully we're making films that make a better world, or make people look at the world a different way. Hopefully, maybe make films that make people treat other people better.
Oh, there's something, you know. Speaking of, and we'll definitely not get into this because it's just a waste of oxygen, but. I was reading today that House of Cards got canceled because the writers are like, we can't compare with this shit that's going on in the world. they're like stumped for storylines. They even started to have one of Kevin Spacey having something to do with Russia. And I had made the comment, and I can say this because I'm full Mexican and I will move on, is that, or not, my mother's Mexican, so I'm Mexican, is that I said, I really don't think anyone's going to buy that all of a sudden Kevin Spacey's new thing is to get all the Mexicans out of the country. So, you know, that show, so it just pulls from the headlines, right? Like, I've always said that those writers have the hardest job because they have to make it look like it's going on, but then they also have, they just read the newspaper for their material. And so the way that last season ended, I had chills. I couldn't even speak. So the sad news that I had to announce, filmmakers, and I think it's old news, but House of Cards is getting the axe.
The other thing too is the news cycle moves so quickly right now because every 24 hours is something insane that comes out that's like incomprehensible, something ridiculous.
Yes.
And then the other thing too is social media. The way social media is, it's always a pushing the outrage button. There's always something that you know, one side or the other. As a filmmaker, I try to stay as objective as possible. But I think there's a couple of universal things, regardless if you're a Republican, Democrat, socialist, communist. You got to treat people right. You got to treat people fairly, and hopefully our art reflects that. And in times of turmoil, sometimes the only thing that's real is art. That's the other thing. We can kind of the stability is comes from, you know, I mean, a lot of times too, you know, when something crazy happens and you're fumbling around, you know, the news and it's not giving you what you want to hear, you know, sometimes a comedian or some amazing little short film or something will help you, will give you perspective beyond, you know, the noise and the clutter. That's the other thing too, is I really think that, especially in, I mean, I think in our, you know, United States, America, whatever, there definitely is, a lack of respect for the artist. And also, again, there's different types of films that are made. Obviously, the people make big budget movies. You know, I'm really more focused in on people that make indie films. I'm talking about, you know, us, you know, people that don't necessarily have a large budget, maybe are telling a story that hasn't been, you know, told before, or trying to, you know, not making something that's good. I want to make the next Guardians of the Galaxy. I have no ambition to make the next Star Wars in my life. My thing is I want to make small films about big ideas, and that's my objective. And if I'm a small fry, or if I'm a, you know, whatever, low budget guy or whatever, at least I can stick to my integrity and say this is my objective. And, you know, I don't know. I can be sanctimonious like I am right now.
No. That's a key thing that I remember our film school teachers would tell us, would just be like, you know, you don't have to be the big budget guy. You don't have to be the guy who works with De Niro. You don't have to be what you want to, be what you want to be. Cause ultimately your path is going to be your path, and your path isn't Scorsese's path, and Scorsese's path isn't yours. So stop trying to be every film that you watch. You know, like, there's only one Woody Allen. That's why he's Woody Allen, you know, like, so
yeah,
I appreciate that you brought up that point.
I think the films that always inspire me are always about identity. You know, there are about someone's identity, about their personality. That's why I think it's important that there's more women directors and more people of color and just you know, people of different sexual orientations making movies, because if there's an element of excitement when you learn about someone's, you know, someone's what they like or what they dislike, or what, you know, a different perspective they get that opens your mind. You know, there is a tendency for filmmaking because of the cost, you know, and the expense of making something of a larger scale. You know, it tends to be the bastion of a white middle class male. You know, sometimes I go to film festivals and I'm, you know, always delighted to see all these interesting, cool, diverse people. Sometimes I go to film festivals and you see a lot of white middle-class males. I'm not saying they're not bad, and they're not saying they're not bad filmmakers. I'm saying that I think that we all have hunger to tell a story. We're filmmakers, and it's important to hear a lot of different stories.
Well, right, and there's obviously the Academy Awards is what. You know, and let's face it, it's tough because so many filmmakers, especially indies, I don't point anyone out, obviously, but I meet a lot of filmmakers, of course, and what our show does, and it's interesting when you hear the point of view of where a filmmaker is just interested in if they win a festival, or they're just interested in if it reaches an audience, or they're just surprised they're even playing a festival, and you hear all the, you know, there's 6 or 8 different reasons, and I like how the Oscars kind of opened some more doors this year. I felt it was the reason for it was a little bit more to say, look, we're opening doors, which I like a little bit more when people are polite to me and that they're not polite just to say they're being polite. Don't get me wrong, Viola Davis, I watched Fences and I was like, just give her the Oscar today. Don't even bother nominating others. I saw Moonlight and I thought, this guy is the perfect craft dealer that I've not dealt with, but have seen in ghettos. I've been in like the U.S. ghettos of like Cleveland and Detroit and the Bronx and through all my travels. And I'm like, okay, yep, that's the dude that was on the corner. That was the dude that I saw and just turned the other way and hoped he didn't see me. And so like you're saying, diversity, but I remember speaking of social media, somebody posted on Facebook the next day, they said, so who cares that Viola Davis, and I hate that I pronounce his name wrong, so I don't even try. I feel so bad saying that. It sounds so racist. The guy who won for Moonlight, they said, who cares that they won? There was no transgender directing nominees. There was no Asian directing nominees. There was no, 3 years in a row, like I said, I'm Mexican. I can say it, a Mexican cinematographer won the Oscar, but it's like, there was no Chinese best actors or best actresses. So they were like, so, oh, well, Denzel getting nominated. So that, what surprises that? Or Viola Davis, what surprises that? And Octavia Spencer, they're the kind of new. Good?
There was a situation with a transgender artist who they let all the other performers perform their song. And they didn't, and they invited the transgender artist because they were nominated for the Oscar, but they didn't let them sing their song. So I don't know. I just think that there's that's not fair. I don't know. I think that it's not necessarily an issue of exclusion or inclusion. It's just about, having a wider palette and making sure that there's, that excellent films get seen and get a spotlight on them. I don't know, when you go to film festivals and especially competitive ones where everyone's like, whatever, you're going to try to win the jury award or try to win the audience award, or, they have a few plum awards and there's, maybe 12, 14 films vying for that award. And then you sit down. I'm at the festival. My film's there. I'm trying to support these filmmakers. I'm sitting down and watching their films. I'm like, you can give the award to that film. You can give the award to that film. It's like it's all subjective. A comedic film that you fall on the floor and laugh like my friend Josh Hope's film, The Life and Death of an Unhappily Married Man. Incredibly funny film. And then you see this wonderfully charming film that has Bigfoot in it. And it's like, how can you compare these two films? How can you actually compare these films? That's Corbin Sellekin's movie, Patterson's Wager, that I mentioned about. It's about Bigfoot. It's a great film. And both of those films are available on iTunes. So check them out if you can. But again, two films. One film is kind of crass and has nudity and it's just kind of wild. The other film is basically a family film. It's like, how do you compare? Which film is better? It's just about a matter of taste because both films are excellent and wonderful. both films are funny and charming and beautiful. So it's like, you know, I mean, I was in this situation too, where, you know, I mean, with Seahorses, where we won awards, and sometimes I would be go up to the podium and I'm like, I felt sorry for the other filmmakers because I felt their films were better. I mean, or more interesting. I mean, not that I mean, I probably had seen my film, you know, I don't know, 900 times. So, you know, I don't know, but, and I'm very self-critical on my own work, but it's kind of a thing where these, you know, these awards sometimes are political, sometimes they're very subjective, and so when there's a kind of a little seismic shift in what, let's say, the Oscars decide to maybe, you know, reward people a little, or give films a little, with diversity, a little bit more of a spotlight, I don't see a problem with it because it's subjective. You're just opening that kind of world and maybe hopefully letting people, viewers, people who love movies, a broader palette, a place where they can see, you know, different, more interesting films, or, you know, than just your standard, you know, don't you feel sorry for these, you know, white people? I don't know.
Oh, right. No, I mean, it was this year was what really got me was, you know, and I've met people, it seems to be like they just love it, and I've met people who didn't like it with Moonlight, was that I didn't notice as I was watching it. One of our producers is a gay man, and he's 72, and he lived in San Francisco during Harvey Milk times and the Castro, and then through AIDS protests and all that, and he mentioned this. We were talking about Moonlight. He saw it first. After I saw it, he said, the reason why I liked Moonlight was because I've seen that movie 100 times, but this did it differently. And when he said that, I said, what do you mean you've seen this movie? He said, well, it's every gay movie. A guy gets bullied, then a guy's stuck with his demons, and then a guy kills himself, or a guy just gets stuck with his demons and goes down a bad path. He goes, but this removed all of that. Well, I looked at it and went, wait a minute, what do you mean Moonlight's a gay film? And that's what really hit what you were just talking about, the perception of something can be really funny or really dark or really, was I never thought it was a gay film. In fact, you know, it's been out, go see it. I mean, when the only sex scene is between two men and it's about a man wanting to find a long lost lover, but how do you not think that's a gay film? Because I think it so went past any judgments or bullshit that society puts on us, that it was like, this is just a unique story. You know, the guy didn't have a dad. The guy followed what he saw around him, and who cares that it was a gay thing? So for it to say the LGBT film, the first one to win Best Picture, I've had people get mad at me when I don't want to label something. So that's why I find it really interesting what you were saying about stories can just be stories, and they don't necessarily have to be, oh, hey, look, it's a black guy. It's like, no, it's just a good story. That's what I learned.
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, being human, it's all about universal themes. And that's, I mean, you were talking about Lion, and the thing that attracted you was this, you know, this you know, the brother relationship that you connected with, and we're all human. Sometimes we have problems with our family, we have problems with our loved ones, I think that, you know, that's the one thing that's interesting about filmmakers is, you know, when we can, you know, communicate and present the human experience. That's the power, you know, the power of creating something that other people can identify with. I don't know, you know, the other thing too is like, you know, I remember when I was, I mean, go back to myself, when I was making Seahorses, I was dealing with, the decline and, you know, subsequent death of my parents. And I needed to say something, you know, something about my experience, my life, how I was feeling. And in some ways I didn't think, oh, this will sell in the marketplace or this will do well in the film fest. it was sort of a thing where it's like I need to communicate this specific moment in my life for me and how I'm feeling and try to capture it in a bottle that, you know, the feeling of loss, the feeling of you know, is there hope? Is the, you know, feeling of what exactly am I going to do? How am I going to move on and proceed? And in some ways, maybe working out these situations while I was making the film. So I didn't think about that the film was relatable to other people. I was thinking, okay, let me work this situation out and maybe people will identify with it, but I'm going to be very, you know, as specific as I can in certain respects, you know, and, you know, once it was made, you know, it's funny, people identified it as, you know, oh, this is, you know, beautiful film or whatever, but they didn't understand how deeply personal it was. And in fact, when I would screen the films, you know, I'd go to these festivals and screen the film like a lot of different places, I would experience kind of sort of this cathartic, weird going back to that, back in time when I was dealing with these sort of very, very heavy life and death issues with my family.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if it's, maybe it's filmmaking as a part of therapy. I mean, the other thing too is if you focus too much on the tragedy and the sadness and the despair, you know, you got to do something with your life. Maybe make a film or, you know, get a hobby. I don't know. Do something that is constructive. But again, the issue is pinpointing a specific thing that was very, very specific in my life, and then understanding that once it was out there, that the film moved people who had experienced similar situations.
Right. Now that you're mentioning this, like you were saying, moving on, and I'm understanding more how that film did have such an isolation feeling to it.
Yeah, that was definitely all intentional. There was other things too. Like I remember someone would tell me, I was talking to someone, they were just saying, oh yeah, you know, you should have opened that film up. You should have had them go here, or maybe you could have seen them before the date or see them at the restaurant. I'm like, no, I had to close them in. They had to be in confined spaces because that was me, you know, being in a confined space, you know. So I mean, again, then I have some friends that are, you know, aspiring filmmakers. You know, a lot of times I'm working with like a lot of younger people or people that are finding their way. In fact, I love working with young people. You know, I'm a kind of like a generation of past the young filmmaker thing. Even though I think it was so funny, I was up at this film festival and they gave me this award. It was like the aspiring. No. It was the Emerging Artist Award, and they handed it to me. I'm like, I'm 50 years old. I can't. I'm not emerging anymore. I stopped emerging. But the thing is that, you write what you know, and sometimes your story is the most compelling story if you're brave enough. You know, a lot of people don't want to write their, maybe their personal life, or want to put their family out there, or you know, maybe they want to, you know, ease into that type of thing. Or maybe if you're writing about your family, maybe there's an interesting metaphor or an interesting way that you can, you know, sort of shield that. I always recommend, you know, filmmakers not to sell out, especially if they're making their first film. You know, don't make a torture porn movie, or don't make a monster movie unless the monster is your family. No.
I mean, that's, you know, there's that saying where when people say you don't, you know, I've heard that said a few times where it's like, I don't know what to write about. It's like everybody has a family. Like,
yeah,
some
start
of those,
there.
That's why those stories, you know, it's why those stories work about the, I mean, what you were saying about how you could apply something to your film. I always think of Ordinary People, where it's one of those films where it's like, it's such a great film, and it's and you can reference it as Redford's first directing or his directing debut, and but it's like the most depressing film, but it's like it's significant historically because Timothy Hutton winning an Oscar when he's like 16 or 17. But I didn't find out for a couple of decades after I saw it. I can't believe that film's 37 years old. I'm 38. Was that Timothy Hutton's dad had died like 3 or 4 weeks before they were going to shoot. So Redford said, "Hey, that's obviously, you know, you can fall out and, you know, no one's going to sue you. And I'm just like, do your thing." And Timothy Hutton was like, "No, I want to use it." And so people see that film, and for so many years I would hear, how did he do that? He was a teenage actor. How could you possibly show that much real pain and real anger? And it was like, well, no shit. The guy lost his dad 3 weeks before shooting. So
I was going to say the Bob Fosse movie, All That Jazz. That film could only be made by a crazed drug addict maniac who went through the fire. I mean, I don't know if he reformed. I think he just kept on going. But the idea that he made this masterpiece film from his life experience. It's definitely very interesting when you see. I I'm not saying like genre can't be something that reflects people's life. I just think that the genre sometimes, you know, falls back onto people just basically using tropes that they've seen in other movies. Like, oh, that great scene in the cabin in the woods when the, you know, killer has the knife. Or that's a cool scene. And, you know, or, oh, I saw this in Friday the 13th. I'd love to recreate it. Maybe technically you can do some interesting things, but will that resonate? You know, will that resonate in your soul? And I think that if you're making genre, maybe something more like The Babadook, or, you know, something that has informed personal life experience in it, that, you know, some of these, you know, elevated horror films where, you know, the people are real flesh and blood, real people, and you know, the villain or the death is sort of an interesting metaphor for whatever, for something in someone's life. So I'm not saying that when I'm saying sell out, I mean, you guys know when you're selling out, when you're saying I'm making something because this'll sell, or I'm making something because this'll people are going to love this because everyone else is making the same thing. You know, yeah, I don't know. It's a difference between people like the same making, building walls. You know, they're just building walls, or you're actually making art. You know, it's like if you want to build a wall, that's great. You know, go ahead. You know, you just trump out.
No, there is that. It's why I don't tell people what they are, because the films that I have on Netflix, DVD, or Amazon Prime as a producer were just schlock. Past what you have to do to build a resume and to get your name out there. I remember a former mentor of mine. He ended up being the biggest screw job I've ever met. But he said to me, he goes, you know, in reality, at a certain point, this was, of course, before streaming, he said, they really don't care what it is. It's just if they can go to Blockbuster and see it on the shelf, then you're in there. But we have our next caller calling in, Jason. So I wanted to say thank you so much for your time. And actually,
do you know
Elizabeth from CineQuest? Hello, Elizabeth. Is that you?
Hi.
Hi, Elizabeth. Do you know Jason from CineQuest?
I met a couple of Jasons, depending on which
Jason was subculture.
I was the insane one.
What's that? The insane.
Do you remember like the insane guy who's like wouldn't leave you alone? No, the guy with the hat. No, actually, I'm not sure. What's your full name, Elizabeth?
Elizabeth J. Lee Davis.
Okay, cool. What was your film there?
It was Le Petit Mort.
Okay. I think we met like once very quickly. And then I saw your excellent short in The Block.
Oh.
So I was there at the Hammer Theater watching your film. So anyways, well, it's great. Thank you very much for letting me be a part of this. And go for it. Have a great discussion, and thanks for letting me be part of 200.
Oh, you're welcome, Jason, and thanks for putting me on cardboard and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. I live to print your name on cardboard.
I appreciate it every time. You have a great day, man.
That was the pull quote on his on my latest postcard. Nobody knows what that meant. All right, see you guys. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Aloha, Elizabeth. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Just rolling with episode 200 here. Pardon?
Yeah, congrats.
Oh, thank you. It's I did comment in the beginning of the show how I remember on the day of episode one, I was thinking, well, this will last 4 or 5 episodes, and then we don't need to worry about anything past that. So,
wow.
Stop it, Doug. Stop it. Oh my gosh, of course. The dog has to be going nuts. Okay, so the theme of today of people have been actually talking about something that they saw recently or talking about a film they revisited. So I think we could stick with that theme. Is there something you would like to discuss that you've checked out? It can be something you never saw or something that you watched again.
Yeah, there was actually this film that I saw at Cinequest called Lazy Bones, that's directed by Michael Jones, this lovely Australian man, and co-written and produced with his partner, Caitlin Ferugia, and I absolutely loved it. It was made with a super tiny budget and shot in Melbourne, and it's about this Uber driver and aspiring stand-up comedian, like, I think, like, mid to late 20s man who is trying to navigate dating and life and what it all means. And I just thought it was really super funny and really touching and honest. So I recommend it to anybody.
And it was called Lazy Bones?
Lazy Bones, yes. Did you get a chance to see it?
No. You know, CineQuest was... I stayed there for 2 days, and I actually mentioned that in the beginning because when I was talking about how we were going to have a few people on the show today from it, was that that film just seemed like the craziest festival to me. Like, it was like I was only there 2 days, but when I came home, I felt like I was gone a month, like in a good way. I've never been to a festival and walked away with so many new associates, connections, friends, whatever you want to call it. It just seemed like, I mean, the Bay Area, as you know or don't know, is like one of the coolest vibes on the planet. So I know that lends to it. It puts everybody in a good space, no matter, you know, people think you sound kooky if you go, oh, it's people have a spirit and they have a space. And I don't mean it like that, but it's very true. It's like, you know, it's not a big shock if something happens in San Francisco that everybody's more mellow than Hollywood Boulevard. So
right.
I'm looking this up, Lazy Bones. I'm hoping that this is on Amazon or it seems like anything that plays CineQuest goes to Amazon.
Yeah, I think it's still doing festivals.
Oh, okay.
So hopefully in the States again, but yeah, everyone is, all of the creators are in Australia, so I think they're probably focused on TV right now. But, yeah.
Yeah, because it lists here as playing some festivals in Australia. It won the Best Australian Indie Film at the Gold Coast International Festival. It was nominated for New Vision at CineQuest.
Yeah.
Oh, that's – well, thank you for bringing that up, because oddly, Jason and I, we were just having a discussion about a film being an indie film – excuse me, and not having to be a blockbuster or just a filmmaker letting a film be what it could be. So do you have a specific, like, I don't like saying end goal because I don't believe there's such thing as an end goal. I think people can have a goal and work towards it, but something's always going to throw it in a different direction. So do you have a type of genre or film that if it was like, this is your film you get to make, this is, you know, you're going to have choice of your indie cast, you're going to have the budget you want, not three times more than what you want, you're going to have what you need. What would be your genre or story you might go for?
I would absolutely love that. That would be a dream. Right now, it seems like my interests are in sort of fantasy, psychological, thriller, drama, romance. I know that that's like a huge, there are a lot of genres all in there. But I'm sort of gravitating towards a little bit of fantasy elements. But yeah, that would be a dream come true. I don't have anything yet that would be my ideal situation, making a feature like that. But cool.
Okay, I'm sorry. Hold on one sec. I have to bring in our next guest. And for
That's
a few more
great.
Minutes, if you want to stick around, what we'll do is we'll get him talking about this because he's worked on some. Hello, Mr. Is that Mr. Steven?
Mr. Yes, Brooks? It is. Hello.
Hello. Steven, we're also joined by Elizabeth Davis, who had a great film at CineQuest, short film. And she's on here. I had just asked her if she wanted to, what kind of genre she would like to make, if she could have the elements she wanted, the cast. We all know as filmmakers, you never specifically get that. There's always something. What her genre would be. And we were talking about, was that thriller, drama? What was the other one you threw in, Elizabeth?
Fantasy, thriller, drama, romance.
Okay, so Stephen, because I know you, quickly here, is there a specific film you would want to make that you could come up? I bet you could come up with six genres. She just came up with five.
Well, I try to limit it to two.
Interesting.
I've never thought in broad terms of like four or five genres. I mean, you can touch on other genres, I think, but I think the main thrust of it, I mean, if we're talking about mainstream movie making, should be two genres: horror thriller, horror action. You know, something, things that kind of mix and match.
You guys are, what's interesting is you guys are both, what I've seen of your work, you guys are both such diverse filmmakers with each other that this is kind of serendipitous that what the show has always wanted to be would be to have a filmmaker that's an A and a Z and have them talking. So we had asked, Stephen, Elizabeth was talking about, or we've been asking filmmakers today what was something they saw recently. She had mentioned this indie film from CineQuest. And Elizabeth, anytime that your time is up or you'd like to go, feel free to let me know, because I never know what time guests have, and I leave it up to them.
Great.
So,
I actually do have to head out, but...
You what?
I actually do have to head out now, but it was great chatting.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you so much for stopping by. We really, really appreciate it. And thanks for telling us about Lazy Bones. I'm going to keep up an eye out for that and research it.
Cool. Sounds great.
All right. You have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Let's make sure that light.
Well, I wasn't, just so you know, just for the record, I wasn't saying it's wrong to mix up many genres. I'm just saying what I do is I mix no
one. Oh, of course.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no. Well, I know we'd had that conversation. I don't think we had it on air of you having that, not goal, you do it, to have each film you make be something different. So
right.
Are you, I don't like to say end goal, end whatever, because I don't believe there really ever is an end. I don't believe anyone can project their, and they can just have a goal they're working towards. But if you were to say at a certain age, say I've made X, Y, Z, A, B, C, like, what would be your, I mean, see, like, your last film, I would consider that a horror film, but as a filmmaker, you might just consider it a psychological thriller, or some people might call it a crazy drama. I mean, where do you think the line is?
Well, I mean, Flytrap, I wouldn't call it a thriller, because in a thriller, you don't, you're sort of going back and forth as to whether or not the monster is really the monster. Whereas horror, you know the monster is the monster. There's no question. So, you know, I saw Flytrap as more of a sci-fi dramedy.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I also made it deliberately loose to open it to interpretation. I mean, that's the beauty of when you make a really, really indie movie and you're not trying to make $100 million, you can be loose with the rules of genre, which is what
Right. Setting up just kind of a boundaries. And so each filmmaker today has spoken of something they recently saw. Is there something that you've recently seen that was either new or it can be a revisit? It doesn't.
I can tell you something that actually defies genre. And it was a movie called Youth. Paolo Sorrentino, the guy who did The Great Beauty and then the Young Pope on HBO, Italian writer-director. This movie called Youth. And I normally, when I love a movie, I usually go, okay, I get the genre, I get what this is. I have no idea what the genre was, and I still loved it. I don't know and I can't explain why. But I think because it's such an original piece of work, that's why I can't explain it. If I ever meet the guy, I'm going to say, what was that? Why do I love it so much?
And did it lean towards art house, or it just lent?
Very European art house. You know, it's Michael Caine and Harvey Keitel and Rachel Weisz at a resort in Switzerland, like one of these high-end resorts where people go to relax or detox or recharge or whatever they're doing. There's very little story, but there's very interesting characters, and the characters do grow, and there is some story, but not in a classic Hollywood sense, you know. But I think there's certainly, I personally think there's a lot more freedom in European cinema than there is in American cinema, in the mainstream.
Right.
You can have a mainstream European movie that is sort of genreless, whereas America, a mainstream movie, and audiences demand it as well, but the marketing people demand it. They need to know how to sell it. So it needs to be a very clear genre, so the poster is a very clear genre. And the Europeans really don't have to do that. And that's one thing I like about it.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, that's the – I mean, we were – but on a side note, I wanted to mention to everyone, if you haven't heard about this website, it's called filmstruck.com. A cinematographer I met – well, his – I think it's his girlfriend. I know it's for sure his girlfriend. I don't like talking about that stuff, but I'm just referencing that she had directed a film at CineQuest, and the cinematographer was, you know, they're together, and he was telling about this, and it's called filmstruck.com. So for you foreign film fans, or of course Chaplin's included because it's Criterion, it's a streaming site for the Criterion collection. And then all kinds of, like, you can click on different countries, and you can click on Truffaut and films that you've only heard talked about that are like these great myths. You didn't even know if they existed anymore. Are there streaming on it? It's like a Netflix for rare documentaries. And, like, of course, as you know, Stephen, but for any of those that don't know, Criterion is dedicated to that and film preservation. So I always love how a filmmaker will just totally know so much about Italian film, and then maybe certain American films might not appeal to them, as to where two guests back earlier today, they were talking about, I don't know if you've seen it, Stephen. I unfortunately hadn't seen it. It's called Ida. Did you see this film?
I know of it. I think it's on my Netflix
okay.
list. But yeah.
Okay. That's what it was funny because she had mentioned it, and I only knew what it was because when I covered the American Society of Cinematographers Award the first year, I only got a chance to see four of the five nominees, and Ida won. And so I remember right. saying, each year, for some reason, each year I cover the awards, I see four of the five nominees, no matter how hard I try. I've even tried to see the fifth one the day of the awards and just been like, you don't need to be going to a movie and then getting your tux ready. Then, you know, so it's like just, you know how it is. Sometimes you just got to turn the movie brain off, right?
Yeah.
So I like these films. Is there something that you can think of that you revisited recently that kind of made you maybe have a different look, whether you liked it more or thought, hey, why did I like that the first time?
Yeah, there's actually a film I revisit all the time. And I actually, after seeing it 20 times, finally really got it. And that's probably the least known Coen Brothers movie called A Serious Man.
Oh, yeah.
And I never, because it starts with this sort of flashback to, Russia in the 1800s. And I never, ever got the connection. Maybe just I'm dense, I don't know. But I never got the connection between that and then the final movie. And I happened to see it again, even though I own the Blu-ray, it happened to be on HBO, and it's one of those movies, if it's on, I'm going to watch it. And I'm watching it again, and I go, oh, now I get it. It's all the seeds of the entire story are set up in that flashback, which, of course, I would expect from filmmakers like the Coen brothers. But I just didn't personally sense it. And then I got it. And then I realized how much better the film was than I thought it was. I always thought it was great. And now I think it's extraordinary.
Well,
because it lays this sort of nihilistic, fatalistic groundwork for the story that unfolds in a very uncharacteristic, un-Hollywood kind of way.
Right. Well, the problem with me is I've tried to, when I think of that, what you're talking about, crazy beginnings that tie in, it makes me think of that sequence in Magnolia that, you know, of course, probably to filmmakers who have been around longer, I don't know how much it hit them over the head, but for me, I was only 21, and I really hadn't seen that whole, the way Paul Thomas Anderson lays out, nothing is a coincidence in life, because I hadn't,
right.
I hadn't lived that. So that Daniel Barry Hill incident with the pharmacy thing, I was thinking, what in the heck is this film doing talking about guys in England who kill someone in front of a pharmacy? And then when you come back to something in life and it goes and you go, I just happened to walk into the grocery store and my best friend and my ex, and we all had a falling out and we just happened to be here and we talked it out and moved on. Like, that wasn't a coincidence. So I think with
right,
a serious
but the
man, go ahead.
Right. Yeah. But that's the danger. The danger in storytelling. And it's funny. I think it's, you touched on something interesting, because it's the hardest thing to show, which is coincidence, because it can so easily be just convenience on the part of the writer.
Right.
To make something happen. You can't figure out a reason for it to happen, so it just happens. And even though we accept that in life, when we're reading a book or watching a film, if something like that happens, if the filmmakers aren't really careful, they go, oh, well, that was convenient, and you lose the audience.
Right.
Very, very tricky to pull that off.
That's a really good point, because with A Serious Man, I think I've tried at least five times to start watching it, and I don't know if it's just not the word, is it wry, or it just requires a sensibility. I think there's so many, you know, it's like I've been on this documentary binge lately where I literally can't stop watching documentaries. I don't know what it is. Part of it is that I've found this interesting thing where I'll pick a documentary based on solely this premise. Is this a topic that I know we cannot just go have a discussion about with somebody in public anymore? So I've been watching a doc on abortion, a doc on how veterans are treated, a doc on women and men equality. And just all these things that I'm thinking, okay, sure, I would never talk about abortion with anyone, but we should be able to sit down and say, you know what? Are veterans really treated right? Are guys that have no legs and don't get their meds or whatever? And I'm not even being political here. And so I've been watching all these different things, the LA riots, and I really started to realize that where I'm tying this into a serious man is I'm sure you have the same thing, is that after you've seen so many films, it's almost like if it doesn't grab you in that first 2 minutes, and I'm not being pretentious, it almost seems like you feel like, okay, well, I know this topic will grab me in 2 minutes. Like, I saw this documentary, the tagline just made me be like, boom. I didn't really want to pay to rent it because I've been using that for whatever I missed in theaters. And so I paid to rent it. It was called Lioness. And it was about how women really went into the Fallujah with the Marines. But then there's a congressional law that women can't be on the combat line. And so it was these women saying, like, we watched CNN and like we were just off of camera, right? And they never said that any women were there. What bugged me was I thought, holy shit, my dad's a Marine, my brother's a Marine, my cousin's a Marine, my uncle's a Marine. I'm the first one to be like, if a woman, you know, they're equal. If they were there, it should be said that they're there. But the documentary was not that well made. And it frustrated me because it was like, you found the coolest story. You found a story that not even CNN will talk about. You found this tagline that probably got an Amazon deal based on your tagline. And then it was like the person knew nothing about documentaries. There was just no pacing to it. There was no, and I'm not knocking it. I want people to see it specifically for the story, but I think maybe with a serious man is, anything the Coen brothers do is good. I mean, it's kind of like, I think Raising Arizona is one of those where I've never been able to call myself a fan of it, but I can watch it and be like, yeah, it's great. It's creative. They're more creative. They're 10 times more creative than I am. Right. So it's like, so has a filmmaker. Okay. So a serious man, let's maybe go on a brief little bit of Coen brothers. Do you have a favorite Coen brothers film?
I would say A Serious Man, because it's very much like them and very much not like them. So let's forget about that one. I have one of their mainstream ones that I find most people don't like at all, and I find hysterical, which is Burn After Reading.
Oh, yes. Okay.
A lot of people, I don't know why people don't get it, but it's a matter of, I mean, you know, we all perceive things differently. But I find that, especially the two CIA guys when they're talking, just to be so hysterically funny and on the nose. And Brad Pitt plays dumb better than anybody. It's really hard to play dumb.
Yeah.
It really is a hard thing to do. But he manages to come off like just this really dull, dumb guy. And I don't know. I happen to like that a lot. And that's much more of a classic Coen Brothers kind of movie, whereas A Serious Man is sort of – I think Serious Man is they're kind of going, this is this indie art film we want to make. It's not our typical kind of movie, because it's not.
Right. And there was that musician one. Oh, God. Was it
– Oh, right. Brother, Where Art Thou?
No, Llewellyn Davis or something. It was
Inside Llewellyn Davis. Yes.
Yeah, and what I loved about one of my favorite with this is, of course, probably their most mainstream film was No Country for Old Men. But
yes.
I liked that because it came at a time where I felt like, as a Coen Brothers fan, I didn't like Lady Killers. I didn't like that Billy Bob Thornton movie, Man Who Wasn't There. I mean, obviously,
right.
Roger Deakins' cinematography was awesome. And so I was kind of on this string of, you know, I'm only going to go because you have to see the Coen Brothers movie once. And so when
right.
I saw No Country for Old Men, my meter was so far to the right of, I saw it with my grandmother. She's no longer with us. And so it was one of the last movies we saw together. So I just, it's always kind of held this special place for me, but it was just kind of like, I felt like they went back to Blood Simple. There was so much visual storytelling. It wasn't about the dialogue they're known for. It wasn't about something that's couldn't possibly happen, like Barton Fink, like living in a hotel and the
right.
walls start catching fire. That it was like, and since I had been through the majority of the Southwest by car, it was like, I felt like, you know, if I ever met Roger Deakins, I'd say to him, like, did you live in a tent for 8 months in the Southwest? Because, like, this wasn't a scout. This wasn't, like, looking at pictures. This was, like, I smelt the dirt roads, and I felt the boredom of what it's like to drive through Texas for 6 hours and not see anything. So that's what I like about the Coen brothers, is you're kind of, I think I've always, I love that you said burn after reading, because I was just looking at that icon. And I mean, that for anyone who hasn't seen it, that actually, speaking of Stephen, that took me a third time trying to watch it that I finally got it and went, okay, because the cast, I mean, Clooney, Pitt, John Malkovich, Richard Jenkins, J.K.
Yeah.
Simmons, Frances McDormand. I mean, you really have to screw something up for a movie to not work with those actors. But yeah, I think the Coen brothers, so given that they kind of don't have a genre and want to do whatever, for American filmmakers, would you say they're one of your biggest influences?
Well, not, they're one of my favorites. They're not influenced because I don't use their visual style or the feel of their movies. So, I mean, maybe one day I'll channel the Coen brothers for something, but so far I haven't. Because they're so,
okay.
They're such a unique, you could look at a still from one of their movies and go, oh yeah, that's the Coen brothers. They just have such a unique stamp that, you know, even if I tried to be influenced by them, I think I would come off as a cheap imitation.
You know, I'm only laughing because I've never heard any filmmakers like admit to that, where it just kind of like, I mean, I've heard people compare it to like, you'll see interviews with Scorsese where they say he's better than Hitchcock, and he'll be like, how could I ever be better than Hitchcock? You know, like that
right.
I mean, Hitchcock for me is, I remember I saw this movie, there's a string of them, Kiss the Girls and Double Jeopardy. There was these string of Ashley Judd thrillers in the late 90s. And I was introduced to Hitchcock. My grandma would be telling me watch Strangers on a Train and watch just all the Usual Suspects. And then occasionally a rare one would pop up. And I would watch this movie and I would just be intensely into what was going to happen. And then my friends would go see Double Jeopardy, love it, excuse me, be like, I had no clue what was going to happen. So I'd be like, oh, well, you should watch this movie, Strangers on a Train. And they'd be like, well, what's it about? And I'd tell them and they'd be like, that doesn't sound interesting. And I'm like, you just watched a filmmaker that probably all they did was watch Hitchcock films all day.
Right.
Like, you know, you're loving. So I love seeing that. And I'm too young to be like back when I was a kid. But I think with where digital is going, I am at a time where I can say back with Laserdiscs or back with VHS. And now it's like Blu-ray, you know, honestly, as much as you've met me and we know each other's love of cinema to the degree that we do, I have never seen a Blu-ray except at the classic film nights that now they've stopped doing prints, because they just put it on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And it's, to tell you the truth, I'm sure you've been to some of these classic film nights. For me, what made me be so anti-Blu-ray was I saw Godfather and I saw Citizen Kane, and it completely took away Gordon Willis and Greg Toland's intention as a cinematographer. And especially with Citizen Kane, because it was like, as soon as you start seeing what the shadows block, you know, I mean, I know we could debate this for 3 or 4 hours, but it, to me, it's like once you see Citizen Kane, if you weren't supposed to see the guy's face and now you see it, you know what, for convenience of size
right.
of box. And so, yeah, so that's, I'm sorry, that's a whole nother debate. You know how filmmakers can go
yeah.
off on tangents.
Well, Right. Well, that's not just it's not a fault of the Blu-ray format. It has to do with how they did the transfer and all the other factors involved. You know, when they really care about a transfer, they'll bring the DP in or the director to supervise it to make sure it has the right look.
Right. And how can you with Orson Welles and Greg Toland? That's a good point.
Well, that's the point. Right. Well, you could always bring in a film historian, someone who has studied Citizen Kane on the big screen and knows what it looks like. You know, there are ways to do it. But
right.
the companies involved have to care about that or think that the audience cares. You know?
Okay. Well, no, I mean, thank you for mentioning that, because I would get my dad's just of that age to where, like, his, you know, that famous, there's that string of filmmakers where you ask them and every one of them says Citizen Kane, right, is their favorite movie. And so to him, it was like, when I saw that in film school, that made me want to be a filmmaker. And so it was like, I love that even people who make films in different ways, but didn't go down a specific filmmaker path. Like my dad's an ultrasound technician. So every day he's creating images of, you know, people's babies or, you know, I'm like, I think of my dad and his work is strung across people's living rooms. This is a picture of my great grandchild in my daughter's belly, or, you know, and I've thought of how that's been his imagery of what he's done for the world. And I'm thinking it still goes back to Citizen Kane. Like, how did Citizen Kane spawn someone to want to, you know, make ultrasound photos? Like, where do you draw that line between Orson Welles and somebody's baby who's 3 months along, you know? So that's what I love about what you're saying about a serious man and how it can draw things and move things. And with that, if I would love to ask if there's anything you could share about Iris, how is that going?
It's going great. I mean, we have another festival screening that I'm not allowed to announce.
Okay.
But cool. It'll be in November. You'll be the first to know when I can announce it. Don't worry.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the Iris story.
Well, that's cool, because we did an episode for everyone. Please go to our new website, www.talkingpicturesla.com. Top right corner, you'll see podcast episodes. You can click on that. It'll take you to the archives. This was a couple weeks ago, so you don't have to scroll that far back, that we were on with Stephen and Cheryl McQueen, no relation to Steve McQueen. And this, you know, Stephen, I have to just say it on air since it's 200. It was one of my favorite moments. Was, you know, the joke is dead between you and I, but just for the audience, I happened to tell the guest how good looking the actress was in her film. And then proceeded to learn a few minutes later that she was the actress. So something I would never do, especially in today's world where we don't need to just comment on how beautiful women are, that there's more to them than that. So on episode 200, Stephen, that really does go down, has the number one faux pas for me. And I'm thankful that you were a part of it.
Well, I'm glad to have experienced it live. We'll replicate it for number 400.
And this is something that I'm going to say on air, because I'm not sure. Highly unlikely Cheryl told you, but as everyone knows, the faux pas continued later on in the day where, as everybody knows, when you dictate text, you know, most people don't pay attention to what the text says. They just dictate it and then hit send. Well, I had written her this nice note saying thank you, and it was great having you on, and, you know, we referenced the faux pas. Well, then I wrote to her, I loved your film, and Steven's such a great director. I said, you know, you're somebody I would PA for. Instead of saying PA for, it said peon. And not like a peon, like a low person. It said I would pee on you. So a couple seconds later, my phone vibrates. She's like, I'll just assume you weren't saying you want to pee on me. I'm like, oh, and the hits keep coming. I was like, okay, I'm never sending a dictated text again without reading it to a T. So
there you go.
Yeah, that was that was great, and I'm glad that you guys had a good the last thing we'll ask you here as we wrap up and then I head into my thank yous is I'm sure the premiere was great. How'd that go? How was the crowd and everything?
It went well. It was, you know, it's a very well organized festival. The people were terrific. We're talking about the Artemis Women in Film, Women in Action Film Festival. Very well organized. It was a great crowd. Good Q&A. It was good. It was a good experience.
Fantastic. I'm happy to hear that. And please give Cheryl my best and tell her I'm happy that you guys had a wonderful premiere. And I'm sorry, I've had such a spacey brain lately. That was her first written and produced short film, right?
Yes.
That's right. Oh, yeah. I feel so bad lately. I've been having just total memory issues from my brain injury, and I, like, forget the most simple
stuff.
She
has a sense of humor. It's okay.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's cool. Well, Stephen, as always, we appreciate your time, your support, and all that, and it's always a joy having you on, and we look forward to the next time. And, yeah, man, I hope you have a fantastic day.
Yeah, it's fun. Hope you have a good day, too, and congratulations on 200 episodes.
Thank you so much, and I want to see you on 300.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, take care.
All right, you too. Bye.
Bye. Mr. Stephen David Brooks, who, so kind of him to come and be a guest on the show. We're thankful to everyone today. Anna, Elizabeth, Jason, Stephen. This is really cool. I wish I had the voice to give all the thank yous I should. PR reps, film festivals, filmmakers, everyone, all our producers, the people who said you should start a podcast. I'm starting to lose my voice, so this is going to turn into my sound editor's going to be telling me, what the hell were you talking about at the end, man? Thank you for joining us. 200. I'm just grateful. You guys have a great day. Aloha, and we will see you soon with more talking pictures and more interviews, reviews, and all the goodies we can get about cinema. Have a great day.